Let's say on all things jobs here, obviously. The September jobs report was yet another one that showed the difficulty of businesses to attract talent in such a competitive environment. One company is finding a good bit of success on the hiring front, though. That is cloud security company Zscaler. Jay Chaudhry is the founder and CEO of Zscaler and joins us now. Jay, good to see you again here. Remarkable stat for you guys over at Zscaler. You have been able to hire one-third of your employees over the past 12 months. What is the secret sauce?
That's right, Brian. There are 500,000 job openings in the security segment, and Zscaler has become a top destination for top talent because we are at the intersection of cloud, security, and mobility, the three kind of areas of expertise people look for. And we have a great environment. If you look at a Glassdoor rating, employees love us. So, and we're growing rapidly, so we do need to hire these employees. While it has become a little bit harder to hire in the past 12 months, we've done very well, very pleased with it.
Jay, it's Julie here. Where are you finding these folks? In other words, are you saying to people, well, you don't have to move anywhere. You can work remotely. Are you saying we'll train you how to do the job if you're not necessarily qualified? Like, how, you know, are you casting a wider net? Because we're hearing from so many companies that they're having so much trouble.
It is harder to hire today than it was 12 months ago. And we are doing multiple things, including some of the things you mentioned. Work from anywhere is playing a big role. And for Zscaler, which is really the company that was founded with the notion that employees should be work from anywhere, so we actually practice that. Now we are doing more and more hiring in any part of the world. That's number one. Number two, a training, active training program for people who may not have the perfect skill set, but have the potential to get trained and come up to speed is a big source. Number three, college grads. We are hiring more college grads and get them up to speed. Number four, not concentrating in the valley for too many jobs is helpful. Being able to go around the country, but wherever we need hubs. For example, Raleigh has become an important hub for us. Atlanta is important, Vancouver. And all over the world, we are a very global company, and being able to hire anywhere provides a big advantage, and that's helping us.
And Jay, are your offices open at this point? The offices that are open, are you doing vaccination mandates?
Offices are open, but by and large, if the local regulatory body allows us to do it. But how many people show up and don't show up is a different question. We don't require people to show up. Many of our employees want to get out of the home and be in the office, maybe for a day or two or three. So people are coming to offices. For example, our headquarters, San Jose. San Jose requires vaccination. So depending upon the city, we allow people in the office with vaccination. Or if it's not required, then making sure it's all positive. Employee health is very important for us. But most of our people are still working from home.
Jay, just given how competitive it is out there, especially in tech land, how much more are you having to pay these workers?
You know, it's higher compensation today than it was a year ago. But what attracts employees at Zscaler is also equity, because we've done well as a company, our stock has done well. So employees, they look for upside from Zscaler equity, and that is probably the biggest factor that's attracting us. Though I'll say there has been an uptick on the compensation side, but being a high growth company has helped us tremendously.
Let's talk about high growth company, Jay, and move away from jobs for just a second. How are things going for you guys? You know, we have seen some signs of slowing growth, or at the very least rising costs, as you were just talking about with higher compensation. How is demand holding up at this point in the cycle?
Demand is very solid. Okay. Because of COVID, digital transformation accelerated because CIOs needed to make sure the employees could work from anywhere. They needed collaboration tools. They needed to go direct to applications. And that's the kind of situation Zscaler was designed in. And then came some of these attacks, cyber threats, like SolarWinds. Microsoft had an issue with Exchange. Then we had Colonial Pipeline on the world. And then CIOs and CISOs realized that they need zero trust architecture because the current castle and moat security, which is built around firewalls and VPNs, is not really relevant. So since we're accelerating that change, even Biden administrations came with an EO that said, government need to really deploy zero trust architecture. So we are very busy. We are growing rapidly. Our ARR, annual recurring revenue, is approaching $1 billion, and still being able to grow at 55 to 60% year over year is pretty commendable. But I really think that's because of the market need for transformation. We have good employees, great teams, and great architecture. And we are solving some of the most critical problems that can't be solved by legacy security companies.
We'll leave it there. Jay Chaudhry, founder and CEO of Zscaler, always good to see you. Have a great weekend.
Welcome back to Yahoo Finance Live. I'm Julie Hyman. We had a jobs report that came in below estimates, just 194,000 jobs added last month. Joining us now is Labor Secretary Marty Walsh to react to this report in a what sounds like busy Washington there. Secretary Walsh, it's always great to see you and talk to you and get your perspective on this report. What's missing here, do you think, still? What is still holding back more jobs being added?
You know, I find this report that we're looking at today is a complex report, and I don't think it's as bad as what everyone's reporting. We look at the sectors. Obviously, we had 194,000 jobs, 317,000 in the private sector. We saw gains in manufacturing and retail that are good to see. In some other areas, the hospitality number, we have about 74,000 job gain there. Unfortunately, it's under what people projected, and there's a direct correlation to the rise in the Delta variant. Also, in the educational sector, there's something going on there that we have to do some more research on, particularly the educational public sector number. I think a lot of people expected with school starting that we'd see that number a lot higher, and certainly that's the number was in some cases not as disappointing. I'll say it was disappointing.
Yeah, I wanted to dig into with you a little bit. That decrease of 144,000 in local government education, 17,000 in state government education. You said you guys want to do a little bit more research on that. I mean, what does that look like? What steps do you take to try to figure out what happened there?
Well, I think just at first glance, looking at it, I think what we're seeing in the rest of the job market with the amount of jobs that are open and not having as much participation in the job market as we'd like, some of those folks that are not in the job market right now looking for work are part of those folks that would be working in the school department. You know, so I think that we have some work to do there, no question about it. Also, I mean, when we think about the times that we're living in, that we've added 5 million jobs, roughly 5 million jobs since President Biden has taken over. The unemployment rate is under 5%. If you compare it, which I know it's not a comparison, but you compare it to the Great Recession, it took us till 2016 to get under 5% in the Great Recession. In this particular case, the president and the administration, we've done it in about 19, 20 months. So we definitely have work to do there. Also, on some bright sides, I mean, 3 months ago, I was on the show with you talking about women participation, concerned about women coming back into the workforce. Today, the woman unemployment rate is 4.2%, which is low. The black woman unemployment rate, 7.3%, which is good. I mean, so we're seeing in areas that I had concerns about several months ago, we're seeing some of those sectors opening up and bringing more people on. But there's no question about it. There's still work to do here. And the issue that we're dealing with here today, what we're talking about, this is all over the world. I mean, this is other economies all over the world. They have the same situations, people not participating, people not coming back to work. So we still have some work to do here.
Mr. Secretary, you mentioned the women in the workforce. I mean, women continue to leave the workforce for a number of reasons. We've been talking about it all morning long. What could the administration do to help alleviate these pressures?
Well, I think one of the things that the president did in the American Rescue Plan is make an investment in childcare. I think that's a big issue here in our country and lack of childcare. Secondly, I think the fact that schools opened last month, I think that helps people as well. And schools are in person, they're not hybrid this year. I think that's another help here. I think in some cases that the higher wages are helping us as well, getting more and more people back into the, particularly women into the workforce. And then longer term, the Build Back Better agenda, the bipartisan, the Build Back Better bill that's being discussed right now and negotiated and debated right now. In that, there's investments in the CARES economy, getting people, more and more people, skills and job training to get in the CARES economy. That's one number this month that we saw also, and actually last month, lose people was the area of care, healthcare in hospitals and nursing, and also in assisted living facilities and nursing homes. That's concerning long term. Actually, it's concerning short term. We have people that need those facilities, and we're losing workers in those areas. So that's something that we all have to collectively get on.
Let's pick up on that, Secretary Welsh, because we have heard on an anecdotal basis that some workers are leaving professions where they're required to be vaccinated. I know my co-anchor Brian Sozzi knows some folks who are healthcare workers who where that has happened. I'm not suggesting that there should not be vaccination mandates, particularly when we're talking about healthcare. But what do you do about that if there are those people who just don't want to get vaccinated in order to have those jobs?
I don't think that sector is just about vaccination. I mean, the vaccination, what I'm hearing, the number of people that do not want to get vaccinated in that medical industry, we're talking 1% to 2%. I think that what people have gone through this last year and a half has really opened a lot of people's eyes. I had two conversations, very important conversations, over the last 2 months. One was in Arizona. I met with some hospital CEOs and the mayor of Phoenix, Arizona, and we were talking about the need for bringing more nursing on, the shortage we have. And I was talking to a doctor the other night, who's taking care of my mother from Mass General Hospital, and said, again, the nursing shortage. We have 60,000 people in this country that are on waiting lists to get into nursing programs. We need to alleviate that burden. We need to create pathways and get more programs open for nursing programs in our country, and also mental health services. In the Build Back Better agenda, there's a major investment in community colleges. We have an opportunity to partner community colleges with those waiting lists to create a pipeline of nurses and medical professionals in a very short period of time into an industry that needs it.
Yeah, that's a great point about the pipeline. Speaking of pathways, there's one other question I wanted to ask you about second chance workers. This is an area I've been exploring as of late, that is people who have criminal records, and both removing the stigma and the legal barriers to getting those folks back in the workforce and helping them fill some of these jobs. What do you think the federal government should and can do on that front?
Well, I think I'm going to say it to you right now. I mean, as a former mayor of Boston, a lot of the people that I brought working to meet with me in City Hall were people that were formerly incarcerated or struggling with addiction or struggling with substance use disorder. I'm asking employers to take a look at these folks, give them an opportunity, give them a chance, because some of the folks that we brought on City Hall, and I created some programs as mayor, the best workers you could ever have, because people want to rebuild their life. They want an opportunity. The problem is they don't have that opportunity. So I'm asking people to do that. Secondly, in the Build Back Better infrastructure bill that we're debating right now, or that's being debated right now on Capitol Hill, right over my shoulder, there is money, job force training money, in that for second chance programs and reentry programs. And we really, if we don't help people that are formerly incarcerated or incarcerated when they come out, you know what's going to happen? They don't have any opportunities. They go right back to the corner they came on, and they end up right back in jail. And if you ask any one of them and you say, "What do you need?" They need a chance. They need a job. So I'm asking people to help them.
Yeah, and that is definitely what I heard from workers who had gotten opportunities and were able to go back to work. Secretary Welsh, great to get some time with you this morning, as always. Secretary Marty Welsh of the Labor Department, really appreciate it.
Employment in retail sector rose by 56,000 in the month of September. Those gains coming after a few changes for two straight months. So is the recovery in the sector finally going to accelerate? Let's bring in Deborah Weinswig, CoreSite Research founder and CEO. Deborah, good to talk to you today. What do the numbers tell you about the recovery, or the pace of recovery we're seeing in the sector right now?
So I'm a glass half full kind of person, and you know, it's definitely great to see, you know, the positive 56,000 after 2 months of losses. But you know, the employment and transportation and warehousing increased about 47,000, which is in line with prior months. And if you think about what we're seeing in supply chain, that's where we really need to see stronger numbers. And with about a 400% turnover rate, in DCs and warehouses, we've got some, what I would say are real concerns.
I mean, Deborah, I mean, I guess, you know, so much changed in the pandemic, right? And we talk about the rise of e-commerce and just kind of the expectations that eventually we're going to get back to this so-called normal of what things look like before the pandemic. But I wonder if maybe the expectation that all those jobs are going to come back in retail, or whether or not kind of the changes are just everlasting. I mean, how do you kind of look at maybe what it did change?
It's interesting in terms of, right, how we also define retail, right? You have this whole new instant commerce market that has really just kind of taken the US by storm. And so you've got companies, right, like Gopuff and others who are, you know, really kind of transforming how we think about, you know, kind of shopping and really consumerism overall. And, you know, if we look at July, which is the most recent, you know, data, there are 1.1 million job openings in retail. That's a big number. And so it's a lot of zeros. And right, and you also have this kind of, you know, this whole new kind of instant commerce market growing exponentially. But I think what's really interesting as well, right, is we have live streaming, live commerce growing. So you also have a whole nother kind of profession that's popping up in retail, which I think will lead to changes, you know, probably in the near and long term in terms of how we think about stores. Are they more than stores?
It feels like there are so many bottlenecks leading up to the actual store. I mean, you mentioned the lack of hiring in the warehouses. Obviously, that's one step. We've also heard a lot about the shipping delays that are happening. I mean, essentially, if you don't have the product to sell in the stores, it's tough to get the recovery going. How concerned are you going into the holiday season that this could get worse?
It's really interesting that you bring that up. We're in our second year now of this 10-10 Global Shopping Festival, which is this Sunday. And we had many retailers who had to pull out at the last minute or who are very thin on inventory, right? We're going to, you know, and everyone, right? Everyone expects a deal, right? We all want 50, 60, 70% off when we shop for, you know, kind of the holiday season. This year, I'm going to say the new 50, 60, 70 is kind of 25, 30. So I would personally predict we're going to see the highest margins ever in retail. We are going to see a, you know, kind of a new way to approach kind of shopping because we're pulling the holiday season much, much earlier. We've already got, according to our data, about 25% of holiday shopping has been done, where that's typically 10 to 12%. And then lastly, another really interesting phenomenon is that, you know, we're starting to see this idea of more dark stores, right? So this dark store idea being one that a consumer can't shop, right? Your kind of shopper, if you will, right? They shop for you and bring it to your home. We're now also starting to hear, which is just kind of mind-blowing to me, this idea of dark malls. And if you think about it, right, industrial space, right, kind of warehouses and DCs are much more valuable than kind of retail. And so there are so many challenges, and the supply chain is just one of them. And one thing I think we have to mention, everyone's like, first quarter of 22, we're going to be in great shape, right? Let's look at the math. It's 40 days to get a container from, you know, kind of APAC to the US and 40 days for it to get back. And we have a complete container misalignment right now. So that's 80 days. We're talking, in our opinion, we're probably looking at 1Q 2023. Before all of those containers get back and realigned. So this is not just a holiday challenge, which it is acute, probably the worst I've ever seen. I think that this continues, and that is where, you know, we're going to see innovation and new jobs created, but yeah, we're still really short right now.
So walk me through how you get to the highest margins ever, because my ears perked up when you talk about that. I mean, it does seem like there's a lot of problems when you lay out kind of, you know, shipping, logistics. Company we heard from Nike talking about just straight up, you know, production getting hit in the pandemic. I mean, is it pricing pressure right now?
So that's a great point. So what we're seeing is very few markdowns, very few deals. And so they're really holding tight on the gross margin line. On the SG&A side, definitely higher expenses, but we're starting to see, going back to this idea of innovation, is retailers starting to look at how they think about buying goods not for resale. And so there is, you know, that opportunity, which is about $250 billion, can also offset, which I think we're looking at like a $263 billion addition from some of these supply chain costs. So we're starting to see a lot more innovation, pen to paper, And I would say, you know, kind of technology overlays, but yes, I think from a margin perspective, right, there, you know, from a labor perspective, everyone's learning how to do things in new ways, which is ultimately saving money. I think they really prefer to have the labor in the store, but it is what it is. And then secondly, we're starting to look at other pockets of expenses, which have more, right, they're very siloed, and retailers are now through technology and really just kind of working together in the organization, trying to figure out some of these complex problems together.
Deborah Weinswig, CoreSite Research founder and CEO. Good to get your insights today. Appreciate the time.
I want to broaden out the discussion a little bit here in terms of that give and take that we are discussing between wage pressures, inflation, and a slowing pace of hiring there as clear. We didn't hit the numbers that a lot of people were expecting. And for more on that, I want to bring in Beth Ann Bovino, S&P Global Ratings, U.S. Chief Economist, joins us now. And Beth, I mean, you're just listening to Brian kind of walk through the numbers we got in this report, but a lot of questions around whether or not the economy's recovery is strong enough, I suppose, for the Fed to be coming off of their accommodative stance to start tapering in November. What's your take about what we heard in this report and I guess where we're at in the recovery?
I guess my take is that I don't think there's any time to sound the alarms that the recovery is weakening. I don't think this is about the risk of recession increasing. In fact, we have a very low risk of recession at 10 to 15%. Maybe it'll go up a little bit, but not by much. I think what's really driving this are supply chain disruptions, and that's also in the jobs market. When you look at, and I also agree with your colleague that I don't think this is going to slow the Fed anytime soon. You're looking at a jobs market that has job openings at multi-year record highs. You have, this came also on the top of the ADP report, which was rather strong. And what was already mentioned, the unemployment rate also dropped pretty significantly. So right now I see this as more just a kind of the mismatch that the U.S. economy and the rest of the world for that matter is facing in terms of bringing supply to the businesses in need.
Beth, it may not be time to sound the alarm, but I'm looking at your notes before the report. You were expecting 600,000 jobs added in the month. And specifically, you said with schools returning to in-person learning, as well as the expiration of the enhanced unemployment benefits, you expected labor participation to go up significantly. What happened there?
I'm glad you brought that up, because the one thing that I was expecting, I was expecting a nice reading. And part of it was that we were seeing some good earlier indication that the numbers were going to be strong. Initial jobless claims were rather healthy. All these other factors that suggested that there was going to be a good reading. And I was also thinking that there's a lot of people that were sitting on the sideline, people who had extended unemployment benefits that ran out in September, thought maybe this is time to get back and start looking for work. The other factor was that you're seeing many schools that have now opened in person. And that also would signal that a lot of parents, particularly women, would come back to the workforce now that they don't have to chaperone their children during a hybrid schooling. This didn't happen. And that to me is one concern. I'm going to keep, you know, this is 1 month. This 1 month doesn't make a trend, but I'm certainly keeping an eye on what happens with that labor participation rate. And that one mention that somebody said about the structural change, that's something that we certainly need to keep an eye on.
Yeah, I mean, there was no shortage of people who were in your camp, too, expecting a stronger reading than what we got here in this report. That was kind of consensus. And I mean, I guess it does kind of raise questions as to why maybe it didn't happen. If, you know, you're laying it all out, we saw that. And of course, Delta kind of maybe undid some of that, you know, stop start in terms of a full return back to normal that a lot of people were hoping would happen. But I guess, you know, it's also the time when you were seeing the roll off of all those benefits. It was also expected to really give a boost to people going back to work. So, I mean, I wonder what it signals to you in terms of maybe some of this lingering effect here that might spill over into next year.
Well, I think one thing that we would take into account, one, first of all, the Delta variant, fortunately, we're starting to see cases and also hospitalizations drop. And that's a real positive. So maybe the Delta variant will be behind us at some point in the near future. But I do think that there's a factor that's at play here, and maybe something that my team and others, other economists across and markets for that matter, might have not taken into account. The fear effect from the Delta variant is one thing at play. Another thing at play is that still we knew this was going to take some time, but it might take a lot longer than we thought. The location mismatch that many people left. Remember, many people left the cities. Many people left the places where those jobs are. Have they come back? Is it going to take a lot longer than we had thought? And this is a big signal for what the Fed will do. Now, we do think that the Fed will continue to move with tapering, but could they maybe push it out a month, maybe two? That's certainly something that I'm sure they're going to discuss at the next meeting.
what would be the case to push it out?
Well, I think right now our expectation is that the Fed, will continue to, my expectation is that the Fed will continue to announce Fed tapering in November, and that they will start the process at the end of this year, as they had signaled. Could they move it further? I think that these two numbers wouldn't be enough. But if they start to see more weakness, yeah, I guess they could say, why don't we hold off? I think there's more reason for them to continue on the path that course, though, particularly when we look at those wage gains that were significantly high. And basically, inflation is picking up. And that's another thing that's on their mind.
Yeah, there is kind of one question to ask too around, you know, we've talked so much about Main Street and Wall Street and kind of the market expectations around tapering and then the health of the consumer. And that's one thing that had held steady earlier in the pandemic, but kind of starting to see signs of some issues there in terms of confidence numbers and just, you know, the inflation pieces that we've been putting together here, particularly on the energy front, I suppose, as well. I mean, when you put those things together, has the case changed maybe that, you know, Main Street's been holding up fine, the consumer's been holding up fine, the longer that this drags on with some of those benefits maybe starting to roll off?
Well, I think in terms of the health of the consumer, certainly when you go, you have sticker shock when you go to the gas pump. Prices are a lot higher. Now, keep in mind, there's nowhere near what many of us had faced when we've had a Middle East when we've had crises in the Middle East, which pushed prices up incredibly high. But that is something that people will notice. But I also want to note on the flip side that household balance sheets are very healthy for that matter. We do something called a financial fragility index, and we look at households and businesses. And in both cases, they are looking at a healthy balance sheet, healthier than over the last 10 years. That's one factor. Households are sitting on a lot of cash as well. You have basically the savings for the average household is about 2.5 trillion over what it was in 2019. So I do think that they're sitting on a lot of cash, and that might be one reason why they're not rushing to the jobs market at this point in time.
Yeah, I think it's going to matter a little bit more too once we hit earnings season to wrap up the year, what companies are seeing in terms of demand across all these sectors in regards to the consumer here. But very interesting to see this report come in weaker than expected. Beth Ann Bovino, appreciate you coming on here to chat today. S&P Global Ratings U.S. Chief Economist, thanks again for the time. Welcome back to Yahoo Finance Live. In today's Crypto Corner, we are taking a closer look at the experiment that caught the world's attention when El Salvador announced that they were going to be making the big step to accept Bitcoin as legal tender. In that push, the country rolled out their digital wallet, Chivo, and actually paid citizens to sign up and gave them Bitcoin in those wallets. It's very interesting. And of course, pushed forward with the mandate that merchants accept Bitcoin at point of sale if El Salvador citizens wanted to pay that route. And all of it's being done through the Chivo wallet. Very interesting to see that rollout take place. There have been some issues maybe around that wallet as people get caught up to speed with it. But the company helping out in that effort, building the rails behind the off-chain between blockchain, Bitcoin, and the Chivo wallet is BitGo. And their CEO and co-founder, Mike Belshi, joins us right now to chat a little bit more about how the rollout's gone. And Mike, I mean, this is big. It's hard for people maybe who are here in the U.S. to understand what really is going on here. But you have a country that had a lot of people who were unbanked. All of a sudden now more of them using the Chivo wallet. So it's a pretty big undertaking here. But talk to me about what you've seen as you've helped in rolling it all out.
Sure. Well, you know, we're really honored to have been selected by Salvadorian government to participate in what they're doing there. It's an historic moment for the world where for the first time we've got a sovereign nation that's taking on digital assets, Bitcoin, in a way that's never been done before. So rolling out a single app to all of your citizens, 6 million people, is nothing less than a huge endeavor. They're about 50% penetrated today, about 3 million have signed up. They've got more inflows of additional Bitcoin from their users than outflows. So things have been growing pretty well. I think sometimes you hear that maybe there were some glitches. To be honest, I think given the size of what they have taken on, I think it's gone incredibly smoothly. And I give credit to the El Salvadoran government for having done a superb job on that.
Yeah, I mean, I guess there's an education piece to this too, right? And it's something that would have happened here in the U.S. where maybe some people who had never heard of Bitcoin, never knew how cryptocurrencies worked before to kind of, you know, use these things. I mean, in that rollout, I guess, what have you seen in terms of the actual usage? Because, I mean, signing up to use the wallet and getting free Bitcoin is something that, you know, I don't think a lot of people might need convincing for. But to use it instead of dollars or not sell it immediately to get dollars, I mean, that's kind of a tougher temptation to resist in El Salvador, I'm sure.
Well, let's see, a couple of things. You mentioned education, and everybody that comes into the digital asset or Bitcoin space, first thing is, it's like, wow, this is very different from anything I've seen before. How does it work? How do I use it? What does it mean? So those questions have been coming up in droves, and it started out, you know, there were minor protests in El Salvador itself, you know, from some people that weren't sure what that meant. There are questions about what does it mean to accept payment? And then, of course, there's finally deployment of this app, which is unlike anything that they've seen before. You've got a combination of people that have never used banking apps because they've been unbanked, and a combination of and people that have used banking apps who just operate very differently. So a lot of work to be done there in terms of people coming up to speed. But the net result is all pretty positive. So I think we're going to continue to measure up into the right types of metrics in terms of users, in terms of transactions. The El Salvadoran government will share those rather than me. But so far, like, all the signs are positive. And we can confirm that.
Yeah, Mike, let me push back on that a bit. I realize we're only a month into this experiment, so it's too short of a period to say, well, this is exactly how it's going to be used. But it's largely still been used for remittances. And even with remittances, it's not a significant part. And then you look at businesses, you know, more than 90% of businesses who said they had zero transactions on Bitcoin. So what's the benefit?
Well, let's see, a couple of things. You identified remittances, and as you know, El Salvador receives a tremendous amount of relative to its GDP, you know, in remittances. It's got a number of citizens that are abroad, and they're sending money back constantly. I wouldn't expect a 30-day window to suddenly open up to the Bitcoin, but we will see it increase. Just a data point, which is not El Salvador, but it's BitGo itself. We've offered to our clients the ability to pay, you know, our bills in either dollars or Bitcoin for quite some time. And for our clients that operate abroad, they largely choose to pay in Bitcoin because it's simply much easier to send those payments than it is to use the banking system. So I'm confident the remittances will start to pick up over time. The second question about payments is one that's really open-ended for Bitcoin and things. As you know, Bitcoin's a very volatile asset. And frankly, volatile assets usually don't make great payment systems. Now, it's volatile today because it's early. It's volatile today because it's not connected efficiently to the markets around the globe. That's what we're working on at BitGo, you know, trying to institutionalize the space and make the market structure right. As we are successful in that, and it's been growing, you know, pretty much every bank on the planet has a Bitcoin initiative in the works right now. So as that becomes more successful, the pipes get plumbed around the globe, the volatility will go down, and then we'll start to see payment applications really increase. So El Salvador might be a little bit ahead of their time on payments, but I think we're going to continue to see Bitcoin used in ways that's never been used before because it's the first time that's been rolled out to an entire citizenry.
Yeah, and I mean, there is the payments aspect, and then I suppose there's also the unbanked aspect there in El Salvador, and you talk particularly about the rural citizens out there who may not have had access to banks. This opening the door there, I mean, is that kind of, it's tough to tease out whether or not it was transactions or more so that other piece there that really was the driving factor here, and I'm not sure in terms of what the data there would say around Chivo take-up rate.
Well, for sure. Look, the unbanked have not had access to any banking infrastructure, and the Chivo app gives them a first point there. I think that this is, again, still kind of early. You know, as you point out, there's not a lot of payments going on in it necessarily yet. As that increases, more of the economy will move on to it. It won't happen in a 30-day window, but it'll happen over time. And I think as we look back at it kind of year over year, we will see that it will continue to meet its goals.
You mentioned the education part of this, and so much of it is just kind of familiarizing people who aren't as familiar with Bitcoin to actually how this can be used. And a lot of that also comes down to trust, I imagine, in terms of adoption. There's been a lot of these reports of people who said, look, they tried to withdraw cash from their Chivo wallet and they couldn't. I realize it's a large rollout, but how much of those technical issues that were reported early on have already been resolved?
Well, I guess I don't know the answer to that question. I don't know how widespread those were. It's difficult to sometimes tease apart anecdotal evidence from actual trends. I think that there's probably been plenty of anecdotes, but on a trend-wise, those will be fixed and soon will be ancient history. Maybe another way to think about this, though, is look at WeChat-based payment adoption, you know, in Asia or other electronic payments, which are similar, where you know, you can be at a farmer's market and you can now pay electronically. Now, those are backed usually by the actual banking system. But here you've got the same user interface now showing up in the Chivo app, where it's actually cash that you control. No one can take it away from you. It's your private key. I think there is education required to get there, but the fact that it's been overcome in Asia at such a large scale indicates the education will happen pretty quickly. And I think we'll see positive news in the short term.
Well, back here, stateside and elsewhere, I suppose, as you know, that's going on down there in El Salvador. There's a big push in DeFi and everything else, and BitGo. You guys partnering up with MetaMask, the big kind of widely used wallet there to kind of access all these DeFi pieces. Talk to me about that partnership and kind of, I guess, the growth, because I'm always wondering. I mean, MetaMask is a big step up. Maybe you buy Bitcoin and Coinbase, that's one entry point, but then you step up to MetaMask and you're using Ethereum, you're paying gas fees. You're in the next chapter of your crypto evolution here. So talk to me about that partnership and what you've seen in terms of people using it now.
Right. Well, this is all just part of the fantastic innovation that comes when you start using software across an industry. And the financial services industry is being invaded with this blockchain-based software. So the use case that we're talking about first with El Salvador is around Bitcoin. It's around, you know, store of value agreements. But what's happening with DeFi is we're unlocking a whole new set of use cases where it's about borrowing, it's around lending, it's about generating yield, it's about insurance, a number of things. Now, DeFi is early stages. It's far less mature than where, you know, kind of Bitcoin core is, but it's growing. And I think it's proving that there's clear demand for these types of use cases, and it's going to continue to evolve. So our partnership with MetaMask, very excited about that. Make sure that the BitGo wallets are able to seamlessly interact with those DeFi markets, and it is the next wave of future financial services.
It's been fascinating to watch and interesting to see that partnership come together. But Mike Belshi, a BitGo CEO and co-founder, thanks again for the time. Keeping us posted on all the things happening down there in El Salvador. Be well.
Welcome back to Yahoo Finance Live. I'm Jared Blickery. The labor shortage is hitting a lot of industries, including the restaurant industry. And we have the CEO of A&W Restaurants here to discuss how this is affecting your particular business. And Kevin Basner here. Kevin, let me ask you, we've been talking about the labor shortage for months now, and can you give us an overview of your restaurants? We were talking over the break. I understand you have over 500 here in the U.S., so you have a pretty good picture, boots on the ground, of what's going on.
Yeah, no, exactly. And this, you know, for us, the labor issue really started before the pandemic. The pandemic has accelerated a bit, but you know, we were under pressure with gig economy. We were under pressure, our industry, with gig economy, warehouse jobs, you know, the Amazons of the world and everyone else that's followed. And, you know, particularly through COVID and so much at home delivery. So we were already, I mean, I was on record 2 years ago in saying that when the minimum wage was the talk of the town and rising minimum wage and everything else. And I said at the time that minimum wage was not the issue. Availability of labor was the issue, and our need to be more competitive in terms of wages overall, and that includes benefits and really culture of the organization, was really something we needed to focus on the industry, and the pandemic has just put a finer point on it. I would agree with your previous guest, with Brian, in terms of, you know, that there's still a lot of uncertainty out there. You know, the recovery is getting more drawn out than we had hoped, perhaps in some cases expected, but we're starting to see perhaps a plateauing of the challenges in the labor market, but it's certainly here to stay, and we're going to have to deal with it as an industry, and I think we are.
Well, we talk to a number of business owners here every day, along with C-suite executives, about the incentives that they've had to provide to workers to get them to sign up, signing bonuses of sorts, higher wages. How are you addressing the labor shortage? And does it vary across the U.S. state by state? Any insights into the geographic dispersion there?
Yeah, it does vary across the country. We have a lot of exposure in the upper Midwest. In smaller towns seem to be somewhat less affected than the coast, for example, in your large metropolitan areas. And you're right. I mean, referral bonuses, retention bonuses that we've been using throughout the course of the last year, and now that's working its way into the base pay. We've taken across the country, we've taken, 10-15% increases in terms of our wages in order to get people to service the restaurants. And we, we counter that with somewhat higher menu prices and using technology to leveraging technology to get a little bit more productivity. So, again, this is an adjustment we have to make as an industry. It's not over yet. But the hero pay that we were using and many industries were have worked their way into the basic weekly paychecks.
And I'm just wondering, you mentioned using technology. We've seen McDonald's and other quick service restaurants really apply some new technologies, not only in robotics, but also artificial intelligence with the drive-through system. Any of this that you're working on as well?
Well, we're obviously paying attention to everything that's going on in the industry. Clearly, McDonald's and others, the larger brands, are leaders in this. And while we're not necessarily playing directly in artificial intelligence, it starts to bleed into everything that we do. A lot of what we're doing with technology is putting more of the ordering, whether it's tablets, whether it's QR codes, whether it's kiosks, although those the jury's out as to whether they've outlived their time. Self-ordering kiosk is putting more control in the hands of the consumer for the ordering process, online ordering, et cetera. And that takes, that does take a fair bit of pressure off of the stores in terms of the labor that they have to deploy to take orders. So that's really more where we're focused on and heavily in the drive-through because as a result of COVID and now the Delta variant and still, good segment of the population that is cautious, if you may, we have a high percentage, continue to have a high percentage of our business going through the drive-through, which in itself is more labor efficient for us as an industry. But, so we're still finding the balance. I think still a lot of uncertainty out there. And frankly, as a brand, as many brands in our segment are doing in the QSR segment, we're doing quite well. I mean, the consumer is understanding of the labor challenges and the consumer is understanding that at least in this past 18 months or so that, they're expecting to pay a bit higher prices. That's not going to last forever. We're planning as we go into, 2022 to things to be normalizing a bit. Getting back to sort of normal price increases and really looking, through our supply chain is the other area that our business is pressured for the same reason because of labor. And we just think that we get through the holiday season and the seasonal hiring and we get into the first quarter, if not the second quarter of next year, I think we're going to have a much better idea of the future. But we think the future looks bright for our industry and for ourselves as a brand, quite frankly.
And we're going to have to leave it there. But thank you for joining us here. Kevin Basner, A&W Restaurants CEO. Well, an IPO led by three female C-suite executives, companies called Pyxis Oncology. They listed today on the NASDAQ after pricing at $16 per share last evening and raising $168 million. And we have the CEO of the company, Lara Sullivan, joining us today. So congratulations on your trading debut here. And could you just give us an overview of your company here?
Yeah, thank you. Thank you so much. We're super excited about joining the capital markets now. Pyxis Oncology is a company that is focused on delivering oncology treatments for patients that have difficult to treat cancers. And we're doing that through a mixture of immuno-oncology approaches, which means we use the immune system to help fight cancer, as well as just mechanisms that attack the tumor directly.
And I'm reading a lot in your notes about something called ADCs. I don't have any kind of medical background, but I understand that it's key to your business. Can you kind of break down how this fits into your business model?
Sure. ADCs that's the abbreviation for antibody drug conjugates. That essentially is a way of attacking cancer by putting a chemotherapeutic directly on an antibody, which is used as a vehicle to transport that chemo into the tumor cell. So it's almost like putting a passenger in a car to take it over to the tumor cell and attack it.
And how does your research differ from some of your competitors, or do you share research with other firms? Can you give us an overview of the space?
Sure. So the antibody drug conjugate space has actually been in progress in research over the last 20 years. In fact, the first approved product using this type of approach was in 2000, and it's called Mylotarg, and it's still used by a number of patients today. Over the past 20 years, many researchers have worked to improve this kind of technology to get this chemotherapeutic more targeted in how it's attacking the tumors. We licensed this technology from Pfizer and from LegoChem, which is a Korean biotech, both of whom had spent many years and several, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars to work to improve this technology. So Pyxis Oncology, as well as others that are out there, are always looking for ways to make these treatments, more effective for patients.
And what kind of timeline are we talking about here for the rollout of this treatment?
So these programs, all three of them, we have three, they are all currently preclinical, which means they have not yet been tested in humans. We expect two of them to begin human trials next year, and the third one to begin human trials in 2023.
And I just want to talk about your corporate structure here. Interestingly, you have three females in your C-suite, and I see in your notes you're saying, well, this wasn't by design. Of course, we're all competent, and this was made on a merit basis. But can you talk about the diversity and inclusion aspect of your business? Because that is front and center in so many companies and management minds nowadays.
Absolutely. You know, diversity has actually been a key part of the founding principle of Pyxis Oncology. The company was founded with intellectual property out of Chicago, investors out of Boston, management talent out of New York and Maryland. And so from a geographic perspective, we were diverse from day one. And I think that actually led to the gender diversity as well, because we had very synergistic professional networks. We were sourcing from all over the country. And so as we looked for the best and brightest people in each role, we had a more expanded talent pool. You know, biotech is often sourced from the Boston and the West Coast corridors. We actually broadened that, and our sort of diverse management team reflects that.
Well, getting back to your business and the IPO, you raised $168 million. And what's your cash position, and how does this set you up for the future with regard to all your trials?
So this IPO, as you said, raised $168 million. We also raised $152 million in March in the previous round of private financing. So we're sitting on over $300 million of cash. This positions us extraordinarily well to take all of our ADC programs into the clinic, into human trials, so that we'll be able to advance our work against cancer. At the same time, it will also allow us to identify other promising technologies, other promising programs that we may want to bring into human trials as well.
Well, Laura, we certainly thank you for joining us here today. Laura Sullivan, Pyxis Oncology CEO.